You're listening to the Incarcerated Christian Podcast, where we shine light on the dark side of Christianity and how it affects people and communities. I'm Robin Mitchell Stroud, and I'm here with my co-host, Deborah Levy Martinelli. We'll be covering a variety of topics, from individual survivor stories, including our own, to the influence of religion on our national politics. To learn more about the podcast, visit our website, theincarceratedchristian.com, or connect with us on TikTok and Instagram at The Incarcerated Christian, and on Twitter at @TICC_podcast_. Now, on to the show.
Sharing survivor stories is a cornerstone of the Incarcerated Christian podcast. We knew we couldn't do that without sharing our own stories. In our last episode, a young woman who left a religious cult shared her compelling story, and today, Robin shares hers. Raised in Baptist churches in the South, Robin's growing up years were marked by spiritual struggles born of religious abuse and neglect. She has spent a good deal of her life understanding and healing what she calls her original wounds, and is passionate about sharing with others the knowledge gained from her experiences. Much of that work is documented in her doctoral dissertation she completed to earn her PhD from the University of Oklahoma in 2015. She also holds a bachelor's degree in psychology, master's degrees in human relations and educational studies, and a graduate certificate in women's and gender studies. To get to the heart of her story, Robin has completed the same brainstorming exercise she asked the people she interviewed to complete. The simple description is this. You start with a circle in the middle of a piece of paper with the words experiences, negative and positive, that helped you transcend. From there, you make a diagram by drawing lines to other circles that identify these experiences and feelings. In Robin's case, some of the most powerful experiences on the negative side are abuse and neglect, including poverty, sexual abuse, and family dysfunction, gender differences in the church, fear and shame, self-loathing, confusion, and a lack of love and feeling that she was unworthy of love. We'll call these experiences the bars. There were similarly powerful experiences on the positive side, a lot of positive things that have come from her decades-long deconstruction, among them her college education, which opened the world to her, her husband and his family, therapy, and journaling. We'll call these experiences the keys. Looking at these diagrams, you can feel her pain and suffering, but you also can feel her recovery. As Robin will tell you, she is still working on it. We hope that today we can adequately translate what she wrote and what I see to what you hear in this episode. So let's listen to the extraordinary journey of Robin Mitchell Stroud.
Hi, everybody.
My friend, this is a new twist for us, but one that we had planned from the very beginning, right?
Yes, it has been planned from the very beginning. I know we discussed early on about when was the right time to tell our stories. And I was feeling a little convicted to use one of the words that I used to use a lot growing up, to let Grace tell her story. And she was so brave and vulnerable in telling her story that it just seemed really evident that if we're going to ask other people to be brave in telling their stories, I have to be brave in telling my own.
Well, you have told your story before, just not in this medium.
That is true. I've shared bits and pieces of it at different conferences and with different friends, certainly with therapists, but yeah, never in this public of a venue. And you know that one of my concerns is that I really want to stay connected in my heart when talking about this from the perspective of a survivor. I've just been studying it so long that I sometimes will flip into my academic brain as I'm like trying to analyze it, right? So when I start to do that, flag me and be like, no, 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 you're not the academic here.
Nope. You are the interviewee and you are in the hot seat.
I'm in the hot seat. Yes. I'm happy to be here because, yeah, I just want my story, like Grace, we want our stories to matter to somebody, to help somebody.
Well, I think yours will go a long way to helping our listeners and people who they know and people they love. So let's start with your diagram of the bars. So those are the negative experiences.
Yeah.
Some of them that you have identified as being particularly strong are fear, self-loathing, confusion, the gender differences, no love. Which one of those would you like to start with?
Oh, my goodness. Let's start with fear. I think I would like to start with fear because I sort of identify an overarching emotion that goes with each piece of my journey. And the journey on the side of growing up as an incarcerated Christian, metaphorically incarcerated, of course, that was all so grounded in fear. And then my transcendence piece of that was really grounded in courage. I had to tap into courage to do that work. And the part where I am now, which is, really wanting to use my experiences in service to others, is really grounded in love. So we might as well start in fear.
Let's start in fear. And let's, if you can, describe that from the perspective of actual experiences.
Yeah, because the experiences are so pervasive. I mean, I can talk about this on the religion side and the family side. On the religion side, I was raised in Southern Baptist churches. You mentioned that. And so much of what we were taught from the pulpit in Sunday school and at camps and at revivals and everywhere is just, it's fear of going to hell, fear of Satan, fear of falling short, fear of sinning, fear of outsiders, fear of, failing. I mean, there was so much fear. Probably the predominant source of that was just always feeling like, anything I did, I was going to go to hell. I was so afraid. I feel like one of the distinctions I was able to make when I started healing was understanding that my experiences growing up were not about, sort of embracing a loving God concept, a loving concept of God. It was really about running from two things, a fearful and wrathful God, which we heard about often from the pulpit, but also, fear of Satan, who lurks around every corner. And I heard about it every day. So I feel like my growing up experiences were awash in fear. And fear hijacks your brain. It just keeps you in survival mode. That's one of the things that I've come to understand is when you live in fear every day, it's traumatizing and it keeps you in a fight or flight state. So anyway, it was just so fearful. And then, the stories that trying to think. So like instead of, for example, I kind of joke now that instead of focusing on the Beatitudes in the New Testament, which are lovely, the church I grew up in focused on the Ten Commandments, which are all of the thou shalt nots, right? And they're scary. I mean, they're scary because of the what happens when you don't follow these commandments. And I feel similarly about the teachings, the stories that were sort of cherry-picked out of the Bible to teach. So, one of the things you mentioned was the gender differences that were so problematic for me growing up and made me really feel like I didn't have a lot of worth as a girl child and then later a young woman. I didn't think that God really liked girls or females because, our plight for our life for female, we were so, second-class citizens. But for example, the stories that I heard about young women from the Bible growing up are all of the cautionary tales. You don't want to be Delilah. You don't want to be Jezebel. You don't want to be Eve. You didn't hear about any strong women leaders growing up. And I know that there are strong women leaders in the Bible, but those are not the individuals that I grew up hearing about. It was all of the stories that were designed to scare me And it worked. I mean, I so deeply internalized that fear. It worked.
So was there a particular event or moment or memory when you realized at some age that all of this was happening?
No, I think because I was raised in it. You know, one of the things that I had to deal with in therapy later was PTSD. So I went through pretty intensive therapy, but I also did some kind of sub-therapy that was PTSD related. And it's because when you grow up and every day you kind of live in the feeling like I'm in a religious prison, and there's so much, you know, fear-mongering, and it's so, I was frightened. Those are all like little T traumas, you know, but they add up to big T trauma. And it's because it's every day. It's in lots of different ways. I don't remember a particular, I do remember when I started waking up to how unfair I thought some of the gender differences, you know, those kinds of things that were unfair. I remember waking up and going, this is really unfair and I don't understand. And nobody could give me a reason that made sense to me. But in terms of the fear, it was just so pervasive. It was the water that I swam in. And it was very effective. It kept me in check. I mean, that's what it did, was scared me straight in terms of, you know, how to be a quote good Christian. But that's just a label. That's just a face. That's just a mask. It wasn't real. I didn't feel that way. So
how did the fear manifest in your family as opposed to your church, or were they intertwined?
Well, I think they get intertwined. I mean, there are certainly differences, but they are absolutely intertwined. It manifests in both by me being obedient. Like, I was an obedient child. I was so afraid to do anything wrong and to fall short. I would be shocked. I didn't start being, quote, obedient until I started challenging some of this stuff in my mid-20s. And then my parents got really concerned. But boy, growing up, I was a perfectionist, partly because when you grow up and you're always afraid, you try to be perfect because you think it will keep you safe. Now, it doesn't really work like that, but I felt like that was the one thing I could control. But I was obedient to my family, my parents, obedient to the church leaders, obedient to God, even though I didn't understand, you know, it showed up in just absolute compliance. I just complied.
So you were compliant and obedient in an environment that you describe as abusive and neglectful.
Yeah. It's a, you know, the some of the practices, well, okay, so there, I have to, this is where I do separate it out a little bit. There, you know, the way that I would categorize religious abuse and then and neglect versus abuse and neglect within my family system are separate. But how they work together is that when you are raised to believe that you need to be obedient and compliant, and if you don't, God will punish you. And the ultimate punishment is a fiery pit of hell. It works to keep me complying with practices that I don't agree with, but I don't know that they're wrong. At this point, I don't know that they're wrong. I just comply because that's what I'm expected to do.
And it was all driven by fear.
Absolutely. And this is where it gets tricky. You know, that we talk about this a lot, Deborah. What the problem is, what I call being an incarcerated Christian, carceral Christianity, but people experience that differently. Part of how I experienced it was as a woman. So I had constraints on me that my brothers, for example, didn't have. And I had constraints on me in the church that young men in the church didn't have. And then, so there is the thing, which is the problem of, you know, religious abuse and neglect, religious miseducation. Then there's my experience of it, which may be even different than how my sister experienced it. It's the individual experience of it. And then it's how I internalize that, how that impacts me internally. And it, for me, I was one of those kids that deeply internalized the fear, the judgment, the punishments, all of that. It did a lot of internal damage to my sense of self, my sense of self-worth, my sense of who I was as a person in the world. I never felt like a good Christian, and I tried desperately to follow all of the rules and to do everything right, but I never felt good enough. Didn't matter what I did, it was never good enough.
Was that also true for you as not just a Christian, but as a human being?
Yeah. It bleeds out because it's your training, it's your upbringing, right? And so it bled out. Boy, I'm a hardworking person. And that was because I needed to be perfect for people to be valued. It was in what I could do, not who I was. It was in what I could do. So yeah, it's hard to sort it out. And then in addition to that, I was dealing with, a dysfunctional family system. I was dealing with long time childhood sexual abuse, and that was devastating in a whole other way. And then you have all of these self-concept issues all working together, and they're not good. It's all like, I didn't have very much to say that I was good. So it just wreaked havoc on my inner world. Sometimes I call that my inner sanctuary, my inner church, my inner space. I just didn't feel, I had a lot of shame, a lot of pain. I mean, we've talked about this before. It's such a lonely place to be because who am I going to talk with about it?
Which is really an interesting point, because you grew up in a very insular Baptist community, a sort of a town within a city, and you went to a school where everybody was growing up just like you.
Yeah, except except it was a Nazarene town, and I was a Baptist in a Nazarene town, which was interesting being a minority as a Baptist, but yeah, it was heavily Nazarene.
So explain the difference there between Nazarene and Baptist.
I'm not sure that I could, or I don't know that they're as fundamentalist, but I don't know. I mean, I had lots of friends who went to the Nazarene church. I played in the Nazarene rec center, basketball and other things on some nights with some of my friends and my boyfriend. And so, I mean, they were similar enough to me. We need to look that up. I feel like we recently looked up those differences and I can't remember them. So, and I guess it doesn't matter in terms of the story. Your point is a good one. It's an insular community. It's very homogenous, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. Not only in terms of, our racial and ethnic backgrounds, but also homogenous in our religious beliefs. It was a deeply religious community, So, everybody went to church. I mean, I don't know very many people who didn't go to a church. And then, our school operated a little bit like a religious institution for reasons that are, longer that I want to get into here, but like no school dances. The parents hosted a school dance for us our junior and senior year, but it wasn't in the city limits of my hometown. It was very, very footloose. A Good Morning America even came out and did a story on our senior prom that the parents, it was the senior prom, but anyways, very footloose. If you've seen that movie, that's kind of how it felt. But so yeah, it was, who am I going to talk to about those questions? And then when I pleaded my heart to, God, I used to climb up on the roof of my parents' house. Because it was a small house and there were a lot of us in it. So partly that's because it was the one place where I could be alone, but I would drag a blanket and a pillow up there and watch the stars kind of cross the sky and pray and pray and pray and pray. And I never felt that God heard me or anybody was even listening. It was just my concept of God was so damaged. Just that person felt distant and judgmental and like, I just felt like I didn't matter, especially as a girl, young woman.
And in any other environment, I know that you are an outstanding scholar. So I know you were a fantastic student in school. You were an athlete. You played basketball. You were a cheerleader. You played other sports, all of which you excelled at. Did that overcome any of those negative feelings that you were having?
That's an interesting question. Did it overcome
or mitigate?
No, and you know, it's so interesting. I think that anybody that grew up with me would be shocked to hear my story. Shocked. Because I was incredibly outgoing. I was a really friendly person. But a lot of that was masking really deep pain. And I was so scared all the time. I didn't let people get really close to me. You know this, we've talked about this. People feel like they know me because I'm friendly, but that doesn't mean you know me. And especially back then, heck, I didn't even know myself back then. You know, I was going through the motions. To answer your question, honestly, I was proud of what I had accomplished in school. Those were achievements that gave me that made, you know, I could at least say I'm a good athlete or a good student or a good whatever, you know, like those were meaningful to me because it was one of the only ways that I got positive affirmation. I got positive affirmation and there were clubs that I participated in my high school. I don't remember if it was part of Key Club or what it was part of, but one of those things let me deliver food with our Kiwanis group, our local Kiwanis group. And the gentleman that used to take me once a week, he would drive and I would, you know, deliver the food to elderly people in our community. But he was one of the first people that I remember saying, and he wasn't saying it just to me. He was speaking with our student government leaders and he was talking, he said out loud, "I love you all." You know, it's like, and I was so struck by such an easy exchange of "I love you." I'd never heard that like that before. So I think people at my high school and people I grew up with would be real surprised to hear about my internal struggles because I masked them very well. And that also is damaging because I felt like a fake person. I was so afraid of like someday somebody's going to figure out, they're going to look behind the curtain and figure out that I'm not good. I you know, it's like, but not that I wasn't good. I sure tried. It was that I never felt like I lived up to what good was supposed to be.
Because there was that constant message that you weren't good enough and you had to fear.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't be good enough to be, you know, I just couldn't do enough to be a good anything, a good Christian. I never felt like a good Christian. You've heard me talk about this before. I never even like there. It's so prescriptive. There, you know, even for praying, and now I love to pray, but back then I never felt like I could even do that right because it was, you had to do it in a certain way. And you had to pray in certain, like in a closet and on your knees and for a certain period of time and in a certain order, you know, and it was so prescriptive and I never could do it right. And so therefore I never felt like I ever prayed good enough. Like I just never could match up. I never could reach that level that you had to be considered good. And so therefore I always felt bad. And so you just internalize all of that and you're judged all the time. Ooh, I remember in Sunday school class, you know, you learn a verse and you get a star. You learn a verse and you get a star. Well, I didn't have as many stars. And there was one person in my Sunday school class and, you know, in elementary who had lots of stars. And I just felt like I totally fallen short. But it's quite likely that, you know, maybe her home life was different and she had people helping her, whatever. But I didn't hear any of that at the time. All I registered was that it wasn't good enough. I wasn't good enough. So yeah, and there was a lot of, so to go along with that, just a lot of self-loathing and confusion and just a lot. And then on the religion side of it, that religion piece I struggled with for lots of reasons. The teachings and the practices felt really oppressive. And there were, you know, like, I just felt like the boys got the lion's share of being a Christian. I just did, because they could make decisions for themselves. And I was always to be, you know, I was always to have a man over me. I just felt invisible. And there was hypocrisy, you know, when I could see hypocrisy in the church, and we always wanted to cover it up. I just had in my mind's eye these big rug, you know, I had a big lumpy rug for my family experiences. And I had a big, so home had a rug and church home had a rug. And there were all of these things that would get swept under the rug that I just didn't understand. And it just felt like a lot of hypocrisy. And so anyway, that's just a lot that all kind of worked together to produce these, you know, I don't know, these original wounds, as I call them, that took a long time to heal.
There's another one that you talk about and Grace talked about as well. And it has to do with these gender differentials.
Yeah.
Ever since I've known you, you've always been covered up, the neck to the feet.
Yes, as I am right now.
As you are right now. And I also know how uncomfortable you are with wearing anything less than a short sleeve shirt. You don't even take off your shoes at home.
No, I don't.
Right? And right. That's not necessarily because of physical comfort. That's because that's what you know.
That was my training. Yeah, that all has to go back to the lessons that we learned about Christian femininity. And, you know, it's modesty. You have to be modest in your dress, and but hyper feminine in your dress, and just modest. And so that is the one thing that I never unlearned. I just feel more comfortable being covered. But, you know, when I was in high school, I was a cheerleader, and wearing my cheerleading skirts, even though they were long compared to today, you know, they came down, you know, more than halfway from my upper leg. Boy, I still remember being really uncomfortable, you know, that I just in my cheerleading skirt. I remember being really uncomfortable. And when I was playing basketball, the basketball shorts were so tight. I had one sweet friend on the basketball team who traded her shorts with me. And I will be forever grateful that she did that one year, because I felt so uncomfortable. But that goes back to those lessons in modesty. And you get judged. I mean, and people see you as, you know, like if you're not dressed modest, then you're loose. You're one of those loose women that, you know, becomes a cautionary tale. Oh my goodness. I was in a church service one time and a woman came in and was showing some cleavage, and the pastor ended up preaching a whole sermon on the, you know, the ills, the evils of women dressing with their cleavage to show and stuff. And I swear to you, by the end of that service, and I was feeling shamed for her. Like it was like I was getting red for her. And when we left, she had pulled her shirt as about as far together and up. And it wasn't a lot of cleavage, but she had been publicly called out for, you know, kind of her immodest dress. And so it just was something that was sort of beaten into us. Same with, I couldn't wear earrings growing up. You know, my makeup had to be really modest when I was allowed to start wearing it. My hair had to be below my shoulders. And there are just a lot of rules about how to be, you know, a good Christian woman in terms of modesty. So yeah, there were just a lot of rules around how to dress, how to be. And, you know, part of, you kind of give me a hard time now. I can't wear a dress without wearing hosiery and heels. I know that is just crazy. And like 15 years ago, I was in a store and I was getting a new dress, and the woman said, you know, oh no, I asked the woman, now what color hose would I wear with these? And she goes, hose? What decade are you in? And I was like, okay, that says a lot. But no, I still cannot wear a dress without having hosiery on, because that, I guess that's the training that has really stuck, is just that there are ways that I feel uncomfortable now if I don't dress in certain ways. But
what has resulted from that and the pandemic and some other things that you have been working on is that you are now embracing slacks.
Yes, I'm wearing a lot more pants in my professional life. And yeah. You know, and when I was growing up, I also couldn't wear jeans, and I've got a pair of jeans on right now. So yay for me. There is progress.
Yay for you.
There's progress. Yeah, but big, I know that we need to maybe talk about sort of how I move from that, but I would mention one more thing, which is I was sort of raised, part of my challenge growing up too was all of the double binds that I felt that, and that was that a lot of that was about the confusion. Like, so for example, growing up and hearing no sex, no sex, no sex, no sex before marriage and how sex is, you know, evil and whatever. And then suddenly you're supposed to turn it on when you get married. But also when you grow up being sexually abused within the context of your church experience, that's a double bind. What am I learning there? And then, you know, we're taught not to lie. That's a Ten Commandment. But then you cover up things that you know about. It just does that kind of double binds create traps. And that's part of my cage. You know, we're just trapped. And then it does damage because then it's like, well, if I speak up, I get in trouble this way. But if I lie, I'm in trouble this way. And so it just is just plays mind games. There's a lot of mind games, but.
Well, let's talk a little bit about how some of these things have resolved, how you have worked to make them resolve, and how circumstances have really helped you. And the first and perhaps one of the most important keys is when you came to college, you described it as being dropped onto a different planet.
Oh, yes. Oh, it was so scary. Coming to college, well, it was scary for two reasons. One, we were poor. And I remember showing up the first day of school to move in, and they were collecting house dues. I think they were like $10. I didn't have $10. So it's immediately that's just embarrassing and shaming and whatever. So just the constant, you know, shame of feeling like, you know, I'm falling short there, you know, so everything's about falling short. But that is secondary to the primary thing is I came to college and it really truly felt like, I mean, none of my family had been to college. You know, lots of my family hadn't even graduated from high school. And here I am in an environment I know nothing about. I remember I had two teachers in high school tell me they would write letters of recommendations for me for sororities. I had no idea what they were talking about. I registered, how nice that somebody wants to recommend me. That's great. I didn't know what they were talking about. Well, that was part of my, you know, freshman year education because I was not Greek and I was called a GDI, which stands for, excuse my language, goddamn independent, which was kind of a slur thrown at us who were not Greek. It's not that way now. Well, maybe it is. I don't know. But anyway, I struggled a lot. And when I got to college, I don't think that my high school had prepared me very well, even though I was a National Honor Society scholar in high school, really didn't know how to study. And I didn't, and here's where my upbringing ill prepared me for college. I didn't know how to ask for help. It was shameful to learn how to ask for help. And so college was kind of two-pronged. It saved me from everything I was learning, but I failed in college, which prompted me to go to counseling, which also saved me, but that one was saving me from a positive push and the other was the kick in the pants push. But I do credit college for coming to the university for lots of things. I started learning and my dad wanted me to be a medical doctor. I didn't have the chops for that. I didn't know that at the time, but I did terribly in my zoology class. Well, when I think back to high school and the fact that I couldn't even dissect a frog, I was just a note taker in those classes because I felt such empathy for the poor frog we were dissecting. Thinking about even trying to be a medical doctor makes me laugh now, but I didn't know how to study. And so I really struggled in classes. I was on academic probation my third semester because my grades were so bad, but that was in conjunction with starting to come to terms with some of the damage from my upbringing. And so it didn't get better until I got into therapy. So, and that was mandated. I was mandated to get into therapy, which at the time felt very shaming. I just thought I was going to go in and some therapist was going to judge all of my sins, right? You know, like my shortcomings, because that's the environment I sort of grew up in.
Is that because of your academic status?
Yeah. Oh, wait, what do you mean?
The mandating the counseling?
No. I did something really bad and I was mandated by, I wonder if I should, that's a whole other story, but let's just say I was acting out my pain, got into trouble, court mandated that I had to go see a counselor. Thank God it was just that, nothing more. And going to see a counselor saved me because I remember going in thinking I was going to be judged for, you know, all of these bad things. And then I was going to be sent out, you know, just kind of cut loose and let alone. But what ended up happening was I felt truly seen and understood and heard and affirmed for the first time in my life.
Because that was your rebellion.
Yeah, it was my rebellion. And I was just acting out my pain is about the only way I could say it. And so I was court mandated only to go once, but it was so helpful that I voluntarily entered into some therapy at the university for about 6 months and did a lot of healing. And I did a lot more later on, but I did a lot of healing, which was great. And then just all of the learning, and I had faculty mentors who believed in me, which was amazing. And then, you know, that was in my undergrad. And then in my, you know, part of the learning too is not through my formal classes. It was from watching other students. And I remember meeting my first feminist friend, Margot Stephan Hagen, my first feminist friend. We were in a club together. Watching her was an education for me. I'd never seen a woman kind of stand up for herself or use her voice to stand up for herself. She was liberating. It was just liberating watching her. She was wonderful. But then in grad school, I started to really look at religion, you know, studying religion, religious studies. And I discovered theologies. That's a theologies, which is feminist theologies. I don't know. It was just so lovely and liberating and just gave me, these were just voices that gave me words to things that I'd been thinking about, but I didn't have the framing for it. Also, one important connection that I made in college was, and I think I was in my, I think I was working on my master's at this time because Clarky and I had been going to a local church. Clark is my husband. Listeners, I call him Clarky. We had been going to a local church and I was struggling and I decided to, we've talked about this before, withdraw my membership. And he was really concerned about me and he was sharing that story with a campus minister. And the campus minister affirmed me. There's a story behind that too, but he affirmed me to Clark and Clark came home and told me about that. And I couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe it.
You could not believe that you had been affirmed by a member of the clergy?
Right.
Is that the gist of it?
Yes. And it's because I had a contrary opinion to the predominant view. And in the religion that raised me, you couldn't have a contrary opinion. You had to believe everything. You had to believe it all and take it on faith. If you had I can't tell you how many times I heard just believe. I needed to understand. I think it's the way my brain is wired. If I can understand things, then I'm just a lot better off. Part of my spirituality is through understanding, reading, reflecting, journaling, you know, writing, all that stuff. And I couldn't just take something on faith. That's some things I could. I can take on faith that there is a power greater than me. I can take that on faith because I can't prove it. But it also is comforting, but you know, back then it wasn't, but it was comforting. But Father Don, and he was the Episcopal campus minister, you know, campus Episcopal ministry. He was the priest for that. He affirmed me to Clark and was like, yeah, we're all just, you know, if you think about a wheel, we're all religions and all, you know, philosophies and whatever. We're all just trying to study the same thing to get to the same ultimate thing. And I just remember going, I can't even, that's amazing. So my education, college was important, not only for the the content I was learning, which was really challenging me in all my, not only about kind of religious things, but challenging my privilege, like white privilege. Some of the most transformative classes I took in undergrad were classes that had to do with race relations and the civil rights movement and, you know, our race history in America. I love those classes. Took a lot about race psychology and things. So it was pushing me that way. It was helping me understand myself. It was giving me access to people that helped me understand myself. And it's where I met my partner of the last 30 plus years. And he was entirely the opposite of the kind of the guys I grew up with.
Tell us about Clark and his family and how that became a key for you.
Oh, boy. Well, he's kind of out there. And I remember my family didn't know what to do with him. He wasn't raised in a religious family. Although I think certainly now I wouldn't say that they're not spiritual. They weren't religious. And I had never been around, I never dated anybody that wasn't connected to a church and held similar beliefs. And I don't know, it was very freeing because he just let me be who I was. He let me struggle with the questions that I was struggling with. And he was so accepting. And for a very long time, I didn't believe him. You know, I was like, I didn't believe that kind of unconditional acceptance. I didn't think I was worthy on it, but I didn't think it existed. And I just always felt like it took me a long time to get comfortable in our marriage because I just always felt like he had one foot out the door, like I was not going to be good enough to keep him, you know, from leaving me. That's another thing. And this is a little bit going back into my childhood that I had things that happened that really caused me to develop fears of abandonment. And so the way I dealt with that was, you know, I would leave people first, whether they were friends or boyfriends, because I was so afraid of being left. So that was really dysfunctional. It took me a long time to figure out that's what I was doing. But certainly when we got married, I still struggled with those fears of abandonment, fears of not being good enough. Like, why would he want to stay, right? I didn't understand my own self-worth. And he never, you know, he didn't cause me to feel that way. I just felt that way. And so it took me a long time to get comfortable. I had to do a lot of healing before I could unconditionally accept his unconditional love and acceptance. It was kind of weird. But so he was transformative for me because I had a partner who just let me work through these things. It didn't tell me how I should be or what I should think or that I was doing things wrong or that I was wrong. It was important. And his, you know, I credit his parents for helping to reparent me. My parents did the best that they could, but there were things that I didn't get from my parents that I really needed. And so in my adult life, you know, Clark's parents helped reparent me. And then I was also able to find other parents in my world. There's a couple in Norman, the Shruggies, Dr. Shruggy. Dr. Dave was my first professional mentor. He was a lovely father figure, just so loving and accepting. And Miss Barb, same way. I have great friends. I mean, my mothers come from lots of places and my fathers come from lots of places. Deep friendships. My friendship with you, my big, I mean, that because you too are so, you know, you accept me you just accept who I am. I mean, and when you grow up, never being able to count on that or rely on that or believe that, I never let my guards down long enough with people when I was growing up to sort of let them get behind the wall because I had to have a wall to protect myself psychologically, you know, mentally, all of that. But
let's tell our listeners why you call me big.
Yeah, let's do that. Well, okay. So Deborah and I have worked together for, I don't even know how long it's been, close to 2 decades. So a long time ago. And now she works with me. We work in the same place, but she used to be a consultant that I used to work with on the outside. And she was so helpful in mentoring me about communications and public relations kinds of things that I started calling her my big sister. And she's not my birth sister, but she is a soul sister for sure. And by the way, I am blessed with the best birth sister as well. She's one of my, you know, my comforters and confidants in my adult life. But that's why I call you big. And that's just stuck for a long time. So every once in a while, you'll hear me say big, and that's why.
We slip.
We slip. We slip.
And I call her Lil, so there you have that.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm, yeah, big and Lil. The other thing that I think about when I was thinking about Clark, I was also thinking about, you know, one of the ways that he supported me was by letting me go to therapy. I say letting me go, that sounds like I don't need his permission. That we dedicated quite a bit of the family financial resources to so that I could go to therapy. Therapy is not cheap, and I went for quite a while.
But an investment in you.
Yes.
And that's what he saw.
Exactly. And so this is the other thing about, you know, the positive things that led me to transcending. You know, I went to therapy, and I had a really great experience in college for about 6 months. But then And that particular therapist, his name is Joe Marshall, a very dear man. He said, as you get older, there are going to be things in your life that will trigger you. Like when you have kids, you're going to be re-triggered because there'll be certain ages when you experience certain things and it's going to re-trigger you. And you're probably going to have to go back into therapy to deal with those things when they come up. Well, I did. I went to a couple of therapists that were not a good fit. Not all therapists and clients are good fits. But eventually I got to a person, her name is G. Pace, and she was the best. I mean, I spent a lot of years sort of unpacking my different traumas, the religious trauma, the family trauma, the, you know, abuse traumas, just different things. And she helped me. It was very gentle. It was by degrees. She gave me language. She helped me with, you know, like she just helped me a lot. And so I would highly recommend, you know, a therapy to anyone. One of the things that she helped me do was to reconnect with my body. I had suffered a lot of trauma in my upbringing, so I would dissociate. And so just keeping me grounded in my body, you know, I used to set my watch to chime every hour so that I could reground myself. Because dissociating helped me survive as a kid because I could go to a different place. And when I was really struggling with a lot of religious trauma, I could dissociate and go to another place. And so part of the healing work was to know you got to stay with yourself. You got to stay in yourself. You got to stay, you know, you got to ground yourself. So even just helping me to learn how to reconnect to my body was really helpful with this particular therapist.
Another tool that you have taught me to use and taught others to use is journaling.
That was really huge for moving me through grief. I had so much grief. I had grief in terms of my religious and spiritual identity, my Christian identity, my family identity, my identity as a daughter. I just had grief, 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 grief. And I would work that out through journaling. Sometimes I was angry, and you've seen my, you know, I scribble. It's just a place to take all of that anger out. And sometimes it was just needing to pour my heart out. Sometimes my journaling was the only place where I felt truly safe to sort of pour out my pain. And it's incredibly effective. It also helped me, like, I would dream journal. And the dream, I had nightmares growing up, nightmares. Lots of being chased dreams by faceless people. I was so scared in my life that is it any wonder that I was so scared in my dreams and had nightmares? No, but like working that out through journaling was really, really helpful. Just helped me work through my grief, and I had to mourn, and I had to come to some acceptance, and I had to let go of some people and some things. And journaling was a huge piece of that for me. And sometimes I would bring those entries into my sessions with my therapist and read them, and she could, you know, help me to grapple with them, whatever feelings I was feeling. And that continues to be a safe space for me. Writing, journaling, those are always one of the ways, and people deal with deconstructing and reconstructing in different ways. For, you know, some people it's being in nature. For some people it's just finding a different church. For some people it's friendships. For some people it's travel. I mean, you could do it in lots of different ways. I've always been a little bit cerebral, and I need to think and reflect and write down things and read. And so the journaling for me was just a particularly effective piece of that. And yeah.
Well, I have seen you teach people about journaling and have them in the room with their journals and at your direction, writing something. People who may never have journaled before, like me, professional writer.
Like you.
Who had never journaled before. But you see these light bulbs go on.
Yeah, these connections.
These people start to write and they start to do what you do, is reflect and think and study and go inside. And then they can write it and it's a release.
Yes. And I think too, it's a way of connecting your head and your heart. And I've always been a proponent of writing with your pen to paper. Now, in a pinch, I will journal, online. I will, send an email to myself or do something like that. But there's something about that brain connection with paper to pen that connects your head and your heart. I have a hard time. I'm an academic, right? And I have this history where I dissociate and whatever. So I'm in my head a lot. So to connect with my heart and my feelings and my grief, it just connect with myself as a person, that journaling was such an important piece of it. And it makes me really happy to know that that has helped you, my big. Yeah. With your own, I know you've been on your own journey recently. Yeah. And I also, I was so happy to be able to teach journaling to other people, because it's super helpful. And some people, and here's one key to that, is you like to have a paper journal. People in the journaling classes that I would teach would say, well, I don't feel safe writing because I don't want people to read it. And that is a real concern. You either have to have a really good writing place or have really healthy boundaries in your family. We have really healthy boundaries. I would never read my children's journal. I would never read my husband's journal. Clark leaves his journal on the kitchen table. I would never read it. But we have that trust, and people are entitled to their privacy, their private thoughts. And if I want you to know them, I will share them with you. But, that's legit for people. And my hope for people is just that, that they can find a place to have that tool for them. But that was a big one. Journaling was me, and still is big for me.
And you have, and have for many, many years, you have your whole family journaling, as you said.
Yeah.
Clark has his, and you have different kinds of journals.
Yeah.
To deal with different sorts of things. And you keep a family journal, your kids both journal.
Yeah, they do it in different ways. But the whole point of it is to do that. I call it soul work. It's like your soul homework. Like I always talk about having homework. I have homework every night. Part of that is my soul homework. And I just shorten that to soul work. Journaling is part of soul work. And that's really important for being a whole person. You can't neglect your soul, your spirit. We have our mind, body, spirit. You can't neglect one of those and be a whole person.
It's part of the self-care that you always talk about.
Yes, self-care, self-concern, self-connection. And I was so religious growing up, but I was so spiritually, just starved. And, that's just one tool. That's probably one of my favorite tools, is journaling. It saved me. It really has saved me. And it's really fun, too, to go back and reread, because you realize how much you grow. And you see patterns and themes and just tremendous growth. And you know what? We were talking about this the other day. Sometimes I forget how bad it was. Sometimes I go, was it really that bad? Because I've done so much healing, and that's the good part. And all I have to do is either pick up one of my journals, which is just full of lots of really hard emotions and hard struggles, to go, yeah, it was really that bad. it's a bit of a gut check to be able to go back and look at those things.
When we had that conversation and you were talking about picking one up and sort of knowing where you were going to find something that had been damaging. And I know you write about those things throughout your journals. And I said to you, don't do that.
You didn't
want to do that. Just come at it fresh.
Yeah.
When we talk about it for the podcast. I don't know right now. You can tell me, what did you do? Did you prepare in that way?
I read two papers that I wrote as part of my graduate studies. One paper was, I was taking a human development class. And we were asked to write a paper about our lives. And I hadn't read that paper in, I don't know, probably 15 years, honestly. And I reread that paper and it was about, you know, I've lived a lot of life in the last 15 years. So it doesn't include any of my growth in the last 15 years, but it goes deep into my early years. And one of the things I've forgotten, I think it's pretty good writing actually. And I brought one of them with me. So there's a selection. There's a piece in this paper, which I titled From Surviving to Thriving, The Growing of Robin. But I had written that. So when I was talking about, I think I was talking about being at my high school. I was able to put down roots and I had needed roots. And roots, when you have not been able to grow them, are a vital thing. Yet, if a picture of those roots could be painted using brushstrokes from my adult hands, they would look parched, shrunken, scarred, and twisted. It would be many years before I revealed that the soil which nurtured the seedling and young roots of Robin was toxic with sexual and religious abuse. Family and friends and acquaintances would only know the masked persona of me, and for many years I would be haunted by shadowed, faceless chasers in my dreams. So, I mean, I did some good writing. And that was just one piece of it. So that rereading that kind of helped me reconnect. And then the only other one I read is in grad school, when I was working on my doctorate, I wrote a piece, just a memoir piece on not having a voice. And, you know, the whole paper was the many ways that I didn't have a voice growing up, that were grounded in religious lessons, but also in family dynamics. And then how I grew to have a voice and how I'm using it now. I'm using it now, for heaven's sakes. We're recording a podcast. And so it makes me really happy that I've been able to sort of reclaim my voice.
Or just claim it for the first time.
Yeah, that is true. It's not a matter of reclaiming. It was a matter of claiming it. And to claim it, I had to grow enough to understand my voice. What's funny is when I get around people who are sensitive to energy, they always talk about my throat chakra being blocked. Well, the throat is, you know, you use your voice here. So yeah, I didn't use my voice a lot growing up, but I'm using it now in hopes of being, you know, in hopes that it's in service to others. That's why I'm using my voice. And, you know, like, one of the gifts of being able to transform this pain and shame into, I don't even know what, like, I just transformed it. It's just being able to use it now in service to others. That does transform it for me. It becomes a gift. I can share it with others. So that makes me happy.
Well, there are lots of recipients of your gifts.
Thank you, my big, my supporter and friend.
One more question. I know we don't have a lot of time, but I'm curious, and I think listeners may be curious about what your relationship is now, today, with your family and with
church,
religion, and spirituality.
Yeah.
Spirituality. Yeah.
I would say in so many ways better than ever. You know, I was estranged from my family, my parents, my family for a while. I was deeply concerned about withdrawing from my nuclear family, you know, for the purpose of self-healing, because I felt like I was abandoning my siblings and abandoning my family. But I desperately needed to do that. And I was estranged from my parents and my father in particular, because he wouldn't accept me. He told me to check my religion as if I wasn't still a Christian, you know, at the door. And there's a funny point at which told Clarkie that he really needed to get me under control, because I was not a woman who was keeping her place, right? So we went through several years of estrangement, and we got to a point before he died, we got to a point of what is that you call, like, kind of at a truce. We were at a truce. We weren't battling anymore. We used to battle. We were both kind of strong-willed people. So we used to, I desperately wanted him to understand me and where I was coming from. And I used to, oh man, we would get into arguments while I was trying to just, I just wanted him to hear me. He didn't have to agree, but he perceived that as challenge and whatever. So it just was not a good, just wasn't a good formula, a good situation. So we got to an uneasy truce, or an easy truce, I suppose, before he died. But you have heard me say this. I swear in death, we have a great relationship, better than ever. I talk to him all the time now. I've fully forgiven him. I feel like he can hear every word I say. You know, I just feel, I just have a great dialogue going on with my dad and my mother. You know what? I the more healing I did, the more empathy I developed for my parents, because of course they came up in the same religious prison and they were just doing the best with what they had. And, you know, they're, I used to not understand why my mom didn't protect me, didn't take up for me, you know, didn't choose me. I don't know. That's how I felt. She probably wouldn't see it that way, but I felt all of these little abandonments where she was concerned, and I didn't understand this for a very long time, and it kept me emotionally distant from her because I didn't feel like she was emotionally safe. She and I have a good relationship. I would say she and I have a positive relationship now, and it's not estranged, and I just have a lot of empathy for her life. She had so many challenges that I didn't grow up with. I mean, my goodness, she had, I don't know, 7 or 8 people that she was responsible for, if you include my dad and my granddad, the same age that I was whenever I had 2 kids and was in full steam. You know, like, I just have a lot of empathy for her life factors that I didn't have. My siblings are interesting. My oldest brother and my sister and I have kind of walked through the journey together, but there's an age gap between us and the 2 youngest brothers. And in some ways, I feel that my youngest brothers have sort of been left behind in my journey. And I don't know. I still carry feelings of, like, I don't know, like, I wish that I could do more for them, but they're grown-ups now. They're grown adults, and I couldn't save them. I couldn't save myself, you know, so to speak, but we are all friendly and loving. We're still on a journey there. In terms of church, now that relationship has been totally remade. I still count myself a Christian. I'm just eclectic. I'm religiously eclectic and spiritually fluid. I still count myself a Christian, but I adopt practices from all kinds of religions that I like. My spirituality is I take from a lot of different things to feed my spirit. The only churches that I won't go to are churches that are, I like to go to inclusive churches. I like to be in inclusive communities, and there are lots of them out there. I didn't know that. You know, I didn't know that growing up, but there's a lot of, I like ritual. So when you go into a church and you can predict that here's how the order is going to go, I like that. That's comforting to me. So I've adopted some of those same rituals at home. You know, I have a whole altar that has, you know, where I can light candles and do things. But yeah, so that's all been reclaimed, reframed, re-sacralized. So yeah, that's great. But that has been a process, but it's a good one now. I feel really strong there. Thank you for asking that question.
Well, I know there is so much more to your story, and perhaps at some point we will get to more.
Perhaps.
But for today.
I have survived. How's that for a survivor story?
That's it. Are you going to play that song now?
Gosh, I wish we had more money to buy the rights of some of these songs.
A little Gloria Gaynor now that we had Martina McBride reference.
Yeah. And not only survived, but thrived. Anyway, for our listeners, thank you for listening to my story. It's not uncommon. There are lots of people out here doing this kind of work. The biggest thing is just to not be afraid and jump in and do it.
Thank you for listening to the Incarcerated Christian Podcast. We invite you to rate and review our show,
And remember, you can find this interview and others on our website, theincarceratedchristian.com, or anywhere you access podcasts. Don't forget to connect with us on Instagram and TikTok at The Incarcerated Christian and on Twitter at TCPodcast_. You can find more information about us and our show on our website. Again, that's theincarceratedchristian.com. Until next time, go forth in love and light.